patient, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
Hi, it's Wednesday, July 4th, 2012, Independence Day in America. And I'm just heading down now to the Hanbury Ballroom again, or the Proud Brighton Ballroom as it's called now. It keeps changing its name. Always been a Hanbury to me. I've been to a good Halloween do or two there in the past, happy memories. Anyway, it's going to be something about the occult significance of the City of London and the various temples and stuff and signs and stuff like that.
Good evening, everybody. How are we doing?
Good.
Yeah? We're in for a treat tonight. I've been waiting for years for this moment in my life. John Tapsell, as you all know, he's been doing occulture since year zero. He was the man that got me on the stage in this very place. How many years ago was it? I don't know now. I was nervous as hell, and he's kept me coming back again and again. And I'm speaking on Friday night, as you know, I'm going to do it at Tower Cabaret. But for this evening, John has, it's really funny, over the years, John and I have got together for quite a few beers, and then he usually goes to a bottle of red wine. And that's fine. So he says, let's have that bottle of red wine, okay. So we're starting it, and he starts telling me stuff about the ancient history of England and London. And for the life of me, I can't remember what he said. But I gave some brilliant insights as to how he could do it better. I don't think John remembers that either, so thank God as well. So this is about the mystical legacy of London, isn't it, John?
Yes, it is.
I remember that much. It's going to be a great evening. John has his co-collaborator, Tony Newton, who you've met, you've been the last few nights as well. Tony's going to be speaking after John, after the break, I think. So give a big hand for John Tapsell.
Tonight I'm going to be talking about a book, and this is a bit like the pub with no beer, because this is a book launch with no book. So the book hasn't arrived, but let's not go there for the time being. What it is, we're going to talk a little bit about London's mystical legacy, and what it is Tony and I wrote a book about the history of London, and essentially it's two histories. There's one, the accepted history, which you've all learnt at school, that the City of London was founded by the Romans. And then there is another history, and this history was fascinating to Tony and I. It's a forbidden history, it's a secret history of London. And the funny thing is, it isn't just a history, both run currently to this day, and there is an argument. Now, if we were to ring up the British Museum and start talking about this forbidden history, we'd probably end up talking to a dining tone. Nobody wants to know, it's not respectable, and it is the work of cranks, apparently. But tonight, let's just leave preconceived notions outside the door. I'm not asking you to believe me, I'm not asking you to believe Tom, I'm not asking you to believe anyone. Think for yourself and listen to the evidence, and you will soon see, as Tom and I did, there is a very different story behind history. Where are we going to start tonight? I'll do my computer here in Troy. Now this man here is a German businessman. He was fascinated by history, and this is, I know this is, we're talking about London, but it starts in Troy. And this man amassed a great fortune in Victorian times. Here he is. He made a lot of money, he was obsessed by history, and he read many of the ancient Greek myths, and they'd been read to him as a boy. And one day, when he was on a sailing ship to Venezuela, he heard about Troy again, and he became fascinated, electrified. And he wanted to go there, and he made a lot of money, and he bought his way into the field of archaeology. Now, a lot of people are very down on Mr. Schliemann, Heinrich Schliemann. His reputation is somewhat tarnished. He did get to go to a place called Hisarlik in Turkey. He was helped by a diplomat, an English diplomat called Carter. And they began to excavate Hisarlik. A lot of people will tell you about Schliemann, and I'm not going to go there tonight. This isn't a character assassination of Mr. Schliemann. He did have many downsides. Some people say he was a sort of Indiana Jones type character. bit of a treasure hunter. Other people will tell you he's a gold smuggler. Some more virulent detractors, shall we say, call him a thief. Others say that he threw these artifacts from Troy down into trenches to support his theories. We're not going to go there tonight. Leave Mr. Schliemann alone. But what Schliemann did do is he electrified Victorian England and, well, Victorian Europe, because he found so much evidence, whether he planted it or not, I'm not going there, but everyone said Homer's stories, the Iliad, Virgil's story, the Aeneid, had actually come out of the world of myth to fact, and it electrified everyone. Academia was aflame. People were getting involved, and it had the spotlight on Troy. It proved that the Trojan Wars existed. And that was something which surprised people, that you could take these myths and legends, and hey, they were real. So of course, this threw the spotlight on London, strangely enough, because the founder of London, in the unofficial history, not the official history, is a man called Brutus of Troy. And so suddenly, people were saying, well, what about London? Well, the problem is that academia looks up to the Greek myths because they're opulent, they're rich, they're respectable. But their poor cousins, the Welsh myths, are consigned to the dustbin of history. They're not respectable and they are rubbish, essentially. They're nonsense, they're a fiction. And unfortunately, a group of Germans came to England. Up until this point, every school child, even judges, people accepted that Brutus of Troy had played a part in the history of London. But a group of Germans, we call them the German contingent for now, decided to throw out the baby with the bathwater. They said, it's not correct. There is no Brutus of Troy. And since that day, everyone has repeated, parrot fashion, there is no Brutus of Troy. And he had nothing to do with London. So Toyne and I looked at this, and we were to find some amazing discoveries, strange things, question marks, and we began to cross-reference the ancient Welsh myths with the Greek myths, with the Roman historians, and we were to make some amazing discoveries ourselves. It was as if our own history had been vandalised and been binned. And this great damage wasn't just left to history, it was left to Hislick itself. Schliemann had done a great deal of damage to there, and there is great doubt as to whether Hislick was indeed the spot of Troy. But as I say, he did electrify people. Now, I'm going to wind back to the story of Troy as we know it. This is Hislick. Essentially, and very quickly, Troy was a great civilization on the part of the Greeks. Very civilized. But it was overrun by the Greeks. If indeed this is Troy, it was overrun by the Greeks, people were enslaved, and the destruction of a great civilization happened very rapidly. Imagine the Iraq War or something like that. Overrun in days, years, everybody, you know, in flux, people taken as slaves, people fleeing for their lives. And this is where the story of London begins. Because a man called Aeneas, who was a Trojan nobleman, fled from this area to settle in Greece. He had a son, and I want you to remember some of these names. Remember Aeneas, it's very important that you remember this. He had a son called Ascanius, who in turn had a son called Silvius. Now Silvius and his wife had a birth coming, a pregnancy, and it was prophesied that they would have a son who would be a great king, who would hold dominion over the races of many peoples. But it was also prophesied that the son would kill the mother and the father. So sort of happy days on one side, but very grim on the other. Well, that prophecy was fulfilled because they had a son called Brutus, who unfortunately the mother died in childbirth. And many years later, when Brutus had grown up and he went hunting with his father, he fired an arrow, and that arrow struck his father and killed him. So the prophecy was fulfilled in one sense. The Trojan community were up in arms, and Brutus was asked to leave. Now this is quite interesting. He was asked to leave, and he was banished from his community. So he went to Greece, And what he found in Greece, as a result of these Trojan Wars, was that many people who were Trojan had been enslaved. And he didn't like this. He was a Trojan himself. He was thinking, my people have been enslaved. So he set a plan to kidnap King Pandreas. And he kidnapped King Pandreas, and he negotiated the freedom of his people. Part of the deal was that he'd get the hell out of Greece. So they set sail in a big fleet, and they went abroad. And they sailed around the Mediterranean, many places. They went to North Africa, they went to Gibraltar. Now, they came across an island, and in this island, they found the temple of Diana. And Brutus, you know, being with the Hellenic foreign culture, being a Trojan, being familiar with this, he made offerings to Diana. And he slept in that temple, and he had a dream. The dream was that he would found an island, take his people, he'd find the island, and he would become king. Well, of course, he woke up very enthusiastic, and his people set sail again. And they bumped into another fleet of Trojans who also, you know, around and about, homeless, migrants, trying to find a new life, and they teamed up together. You've got to imagine, you've got to use your own thoughts here. You've got a group of people who've got no homeland. They're men of war, they're following this leader, very charismatic leader perhaps, who's had this mission to found a new, if you like, Jerusalem. And so they set sail again, and they come to Gaul, and they fight. They fight with local people, but they suddenly say, what are we doing this war? Yes, we're winning the wars, but this isn't our island. So they set sail again, and they touch down in Britain. Now, where they come to is in Totnes, in Devon. I don't know if you've been to Totnes, but you will find Brutus Stone, which is set in the ground. It's still there to this day with a horrible sign saying Brutus Stone, before the actual. But they decided not to stay there, and they made their way to London. And when they came to London, it is a fact that Brutus set his stone in the ground. Now have a look at some slides here. This is Brutus's voyage, a medieval depiction of it. So obviously people in medieval times are quite caught up in the Brutus lineage that we've never heard of. And this is the famous London Stone. He set the London Stone in a place called Cannon Street. If you come in London, into London, you've got a massive station, Cannon Street, and that's where it was. If you go across the road, you've got this one. This is the London Stone alight behind the grill. It's much smaller today. But the London Stone was originally known as the Brutus Stone. I'll stop it there. The Brutus Stone was the foundation of the city. It's interesting that it's still there. And men for many years swore oaths on here. There was many rebellions, riots, things like that, where people put their swords to the stone and swore allegiance and declared themselves kings and all sorts. So it's a very interesting stone. But today, all we know about it is that if it's destroyed, London is destroyed. And recently, in a shop, two men took over this shop. And they pulled the stone out. They were foreign workers. They had no idea what it was. And they were about to take chisels to the stone, and nearly broke it in half. And somebody said, well, no, I think you should check this out. There's some strange carvings on it. And they did, and they found it was the Brutus Stone. Nobody knows who owns it. It's in the middle of a Cannon Street, and it's just left there. Interesting. But anyway, if indeed this is the Brutus Stone, conventional historians would call it the London Stone. And they will tell you it's only from 1300. It's funny that Londoners always consider it to be a very important thing. Anyway, coming back to the flight of the Trojans, and coming back to England, all of I've told you is a myth, it's a nonsense. It's something which people have made up. The sources for it are British, you know, second-rate sources. They're not really historical. They're not to be found in classical sources. And so therefore, what I've been telling you is essentially something that we should ignore. It's not respectable. But I want to wind forward. I want to wind forward 1,000 years to the time of the Romans. The Romans we are told, and now we're going into the official history, the Romans, we are told, came across from Gaul, Caesar led them, defeated the British. There was no London, there was no city there. He made his way to a place probably weak hands there, attacked people. He had some bad news back in Gaul. He went back to Gaul with his troops, and then a year later returned, conquered the British, and set a man in charge called Paulinus, and then left in a sort of ticker tape reception in Rome. It's a nice history, very clean, very nice, like it. Unfortunately, it doesn't match up to all of the sources, even Roman. It's basically Caesar's history. And Caesar would like to be seen in this light. This gentleman here is Strabo. Strabo is a Roman historian, and he says some very interesting things about the savage race in Britain. He says that they were fluent in Greek. He said that they were gentlemen, that they would be well accepted in the Lycia. A little bit different from what Caesar says. And Strabo said as well that they were great mathematicians. Here is the assault on the beaches. Caesar's own records and Lucan's records actually confirm that he was repulsed twice by these heathens. Caesar, in his arrogance, said had no art of war, but they were repulsed twice. They did make it ashore, and if you compare the sources, you know that they made their way up the Thames, and the Thames is very different then. It's not the walled river that we have today. It's a marshy river with reeds. So people like you could attack me very suddenly and then move back again without being seen. It was the ideal place for guerrilla warfare. And if we look at the tactics used, and we look for this source, the Welsh myths, are very, very precise about what happened. They tell us about reeds that had lead placed on them to pierce boats. Boats were sunk, and then men would attack on chariots, come on foot, attack the men, and when it wasn't going their way, get back on the chariots and get the hell out. It wasn't going very well. They stretched the Roman lines, and they caused a lot of problems. The Romans made their way as far as a place called Thorny Island, which today is the site of Parliament. It isn't an island anymore. And this is where a mighty battle happened. The British brought all of their forces to the north, and all the Romans came to the south. Now this is a ford, an actual ford. If it wasn't man-made, you'd be able to cross at low tide. It's the ultimate place to attack, and then on to the north. So the Romans under Caesar went for it, and they came across. Now, what we know of this attack from all sorts of sources, we're talking about Lucan's Pharsalia, we're talking about the Welsh sources, but the battle raged for quite a long time, and the Romans didn't do well because they were using chariots. The British used chariots, and they're very hard to contain. They can attack at any point. The battle wasn't going very well, so Caesar, never one to shy away, set foot into the fray. Now what we should understand is that before this invasion, which historians tell us happened quite quickly, there were diplomatic letters sent by a man called Caspalorn, that's his Welsh name. In Roman history it's Casabellaunus. But Caspalorn actually sent diplomatic letters, and these letters are very telling. I asked you to remember a name earlier. Aeneas. The diplomatic letters sent from Caspalorn directly to Caesar say you cannot attack this island because we are both of the same racial stock. We are all Trojans. And in fact, the Romans are actually a subset of the Trojans, so that's quite true. He sent these letters through and he said, in your avarice, you pick this island which is surrounded by a perilous sea. You shouldn't be doing this. We are the same Trojan stock. We are of Aeneas, both of us. Well, the Romans didn't really want to know about this because, you know, they're getting gold from the Spanish, they've conquered people with camels, they've got spices coming in from the east, and now they want this island. As I say, the gentleman Caesar, he also said the British were no good at war. Then he gets involved in this confederation. It's not going well. They're attacking the north side of the Thames, where Parliament is. It's a massive battle. We're talking about 60,000 people coming across in. In the heat of the moment, Cascalon's brother Nennius took on Caesar in hand-to-hand combat. And this is very well documented. Now, we'll come back to him in a minute. In this hand-to-hand combat with sword and shield, Nennius was wounded by Caesar, a mortal wound. But they carried on fighting, and in his shield, Nennius caught Caesar's sword and wrestled it away. The fight continued until it was literally a fight with hands, no weapons, on the floor. Both sides separated their men. Nennius was taken away by the ancient British, Caesar was taken away by the Romans. Now this man is Lucan, Lucan's Pharsalia. I'll just ask you now, does he look a bit sort of sarcastic and cutting to you? He is. He is a satirist, a Roman satirist. Now he says something very interesting about this victory of Caesar's. And you have to open your mind. Conventional historians will see this just, he's written this. Now remember, he can't say what he wants to say. He can't about Caesar, you lose your head. And he says, I take it sarcastically, you see what you think. In haste, he turned and showed his back to the Britons he had attacked. Now, if you go by the Welsh sources, he just had his head kicked in. Not only that, he's gone to Britain, said they can't fight, he's lost the war, he's lost his sword, and then he's gone on the ground, had his head kicked in by Nennius, and this man's just exposed it. He was very sarcastic. Now, I suggest to you that Caesar fled, and he fled from Britain. If you look at Caesar's own sources, the ships were manned with three times the amount of men that there should have been. Doesn't it sound a bit like Dunkirk? They wanted to get out of this bloodbath, they wanted to get back. And when they did come back, a year later, they came back with double the amount of men. Conventional historians never ever think about this. They just repeat paraphrase of the same thing that they've been taught. They don't think about the intricacies. So the ancient British got rid of them. This marvellous weapon, which is designed in America, is to believe to be Caesar's very sword that was taken from him. It's called the Prokamors. It's a magical artifact. And after the defeat of Caesar in London, you've got to understand this is from the Welsh myth, there was a Glastonbury-type festival. It lasted 3 days. 100,000 beasts were sacrificed and ate. And lots of people came from all over Britain to celebrate, and Caesar's sword was put on display for many, many years. And it's called the Prokamors. It means saffron death. You'll hear many things said about the sword. Sometimes it's wrongly called the yellow death, and sometimes wrongly called the red death. But it's the saffron death, the Prokamors. And when the British took it, it was their way of saying we're independent, and kept it, and never returned it. It's turned up in America last 40 years. Now, if you look at London's flag, this is the flag of London, not England, you will see there is a sword in the left-hand quarter. Historians, and this is what Tom and I found out, historians will tell you, as a knee-jerk reaction, that that is the sword that was used to pierce the side of Wat Tyler, who rebelled against London. In fact, our research has confirmed the design of the flag predates Wat Tyler by 60 years. So the other theory is that this is the sword of St. Paul, who is patron saint of England. Nice story, but that's where it ends. There is only one explanation, and that is the independent state of London, the city-state, that is the Prokamors, which was taken from Caesar under force of arms. Now, excuse the thumb over the lens. That's embarrassing. That's true. We're coming here. We're going to go back into the Roman history, the respectable history. We're told that this is a Roman site, and the Normans used it, and they built their own castle when they defeated the English. Well, there's some truth in that, but it's not the whole truth. This is actually a very ancient British site. Under this white tower is a white mound, and under the white mound are two of the ancient British kings who are buried there. Their names are unknown, but we do know the third person that's buried there is the head of a giant called Bran. And Bran means raven in Welsh. And if you go there now, there are ravens in the box and their wings are clipped. That's because Bran defends the island against invaders. So it's kind of prophecy. In fact, during the war, the ravens thinned out and Churchill got a bit worried, so he restocked them. But it is, that's actually true. This site is very ancient, and we're told that the Normans came here almost. The Normans didn't. The Normans defeated the English. When they came to London, they had the doors of London slammed in his face, and he was made to write a Bill of Rights for London to declare the sort of independence, if you like. Well, that's interesting. So it gives you an idea that this is a nation state which survives on its own. It doesn't necessarily have any owners. Now, here's an interesting man. His name is Thomas Lockyer. He discovered this thing, helium. He discovered helium. Helium means helios. It's ancient Greek, helios, the sun. And he observed all sorts of things in nature. He went around in Victorian times and he came across Stonehenge. And many people say the person who discovered mathematical formulas and connections to the stars is Alexander Thom. But in fact, it was him, it was the very first one. And he decided that whoever built Stonehenge knew things that we don't know, knew things about astronomy, but of course, and mathematics that weren't apparent. Very clever man. And one of the things he discovered, he went through London and said, well, hold on, it's not just Stonehenge, it's other things going on here. Whoever aligned the churches in London knew something. Now, being a Victorian, you couldn't have a meeting like this and just call it a meeting. You had to give sort of a talk symposium or something like that, grandiose. He called his theory, which always makes me laugh, the Faustus Discalendar. But let's not get bogged down with that. It's essentially a druidic star clock. And what he discovered is, in this room, for example, magnetic north and north are different. They change over time. So if I put my handprint on the wall and we decide it was made of magnetic north, you could come back in 300 years' time and say, oh, if that was put there in magnetic north, that was put there in July 2012. This is how clever the guy was. He was able to date things by the position of the churches and by the alignment in London. And he decided whoever had laid out London before must have had this knowledge, this geomantic knowledge. We're not just talking about lay lines, this is a sort of super lay. And he really got behind the idea and wrote two books on it. Now, his discoveries really led to the fire of London to this man. He realised that Wren must have known. And Wren did know. When the fire of London happened in 1666, about three-fifths of the city was destroyed. The king was very anxious to rebuild the city for obvious economic reasons, you know, and he chose him as the rebuilder of London. And Sir Christopher Wren found a man called Nicholas Hawksmoor. The two of them were steeped in sort of esoteric and occult knowledge, and they decided to rebuild London out of stone. And we know all about this anyway. Most people do. They rebuilt 50 to 100 churches, something like that. They rebuilt hospitals, all out of stone. They started to design it, and their crowning glory was in the background, St. Paul's Cathedral. Now you would think it's rather pressing. Somebody's saying to you, the king, get on with it. We want 50 churches, 100 churches, whatever, and a stone cathedral. It's about 40 years' work there ahead. These two weren't concerned with that. They were doing something secret in their spare time. They were looking through the ashes of St. Paul's Cathedral, which was a wooden building before. And this is strange, you'd think that they had better things to do. Mm. They were looking around at these ashes, and what were they looking for? Well, we know what they were looking for. They were looking for a particular pagan temple. And they were looking and searching through these remains, and they didn't really find a lot, so they say. So they carried on rebuilding the churches. As we looked into this timeline, we found out that in some senses we knew what they were looking for. And we began to read between the lines. They were looking for the temple of Brutus, because that's where it's positioned. The temple of Diana is founded by Brutus of Troy. And what's more interesting than we found out while writing this book is all of the greatest sons and daughters of the British Empire were buried under there. There's a small church which was covered by this massive stone edifice called St. Faith's. And St. Faith's crypt under there houses the graves of the tombs of Nelson, Wellington, Florence Nightingale, the painter Gainsborough. It could go on all day, all buried under there. It's believed to be Brutus's temple. So who decided that that would happen? It all became very mysterious. Now here's dear old Brutus, that's a sort of depiction of him. Probably didn't look like that, but that's just my idea. And we realised that the establishment, the people at the top, all wanted to be involved with Brutus. They wanted to be part of this. Time we'll talk about this in a moment. Well, I've covered off a lot of the myths and stuff like that. And I just wanted to end my talk here. The German contingent, by doing what they did in Victorian times, literally throwing out the baby with the bathwater, throwing away a lot of mystery without understanding things properly, without looking in. They used archaeology, which is okay, and they used conventional history, but they didn't read between the lines. And one area that they never looked into at all, which Toyn and I looked into at a very high level, was the law. The oldest Anglo-Saxon documents, natural history, are legal documents. And they were commissioned by King Alfred's granddaughter. And they were written, they are your common law rights. Today you have legislation in Parliament, you have your common law rights, immutable rights that can't be changed. You know, people can't take things from you. These are things which are given. And it is recorded very carefully, very precisely, that King Alfred's granddaughter didn't make up the laws. She took them from earlier laws. She took the material from somewhere else, from ancient British sources, not Saxon sources. And she's very clear where she took them from. She took them from King Malmutius. Now, King Malmutius is a very interesting character, and I'll tell you why. Because we're conditioned through a school education to accept that the Romans were the first road builders. They were not. Malmutius was the very first road builder, and he built straight roads. He had a reason for doing that. He wanted to build roads between one sacred place and another. And whilst you're on that road, doing your pilgrimage or whatever it is, you cannot be molested by anyone or touched by anyone. Nobody can bother you, and it was a sacrilegious offence to touch anyone on those roads, the Malmutius roads. If you look outside today, if I'm unfortunate enough to be attacked outside, I'm attacked on the Queen's Highway. And this is stayed in law over time. If you commit an offence, it's on the Queen's Highway, or the King's Highway, Charles and Wolfram. These are all remnants of the original Malmutius Code. Now, Malmutius himself never took any credit for this. He said, no, they're not my laws. It's recorded where these came from. They are the edicts of Brutus of Troy, of which he was the 16th in line from. So, unfortunately for the current historians, we've got an answer to that one, but we'll see what we come up with. So we've got this Malmutius Code, and it's interesting that highwaymen, when they committed their offences of robbing people on the highway, they were gibbeted. That means to say they were hung by the neck, but they weren't given a Christian burial. The birds would peck them away, and their bones would fall through this cage and just be kicked away because they committed a sacrilegious offence. One of the last things we found in the Malmutius Code is it perfectly explains the law of sanctuary. The law of sanctuary, in medieval times, you commit a violent offence, and this was still in place up until the Civil War, you commit a violent offence, but if you felt that you needed to perhaps, you know, need time to think about what you've done, make amends, you would then go into a church and find a sort of chair by the altar or in the sanctuary itself and say, I want to stay here. No one could arrest you. It's interesting, one of the last places in London, this was going back to 1964, it's only repealed in 1964, there's a place if you come out of the brand new Farringdon Station, you come out left and you go to where they sell diamonds in Hatton Garden. Behind Hatton Garden is Bleeding Heart Garden. Up until 1964 it became a sanctuary there. You could murder a man and you could sell him the sanctuary books. You could stay there, no one could arrest you. I don't think that would actually happen in reality, but it's interesting to know. There it is. So all these things are in place. So when people dismiss Bruce of Troy, they don't really understand about things like this, and they're all sort of clues. Anyway, I've left you with a sense there of what I'm talking about. There's the pub there, that's probably the only sanctuary there nowadays. Okay, I'm going to leave you now, hand you over to Ty. Thank you very much.
I think he's going to resume, I think, now and walk to our group.
Could you summarise
what you just said? Well, do you want to summarise it? He's going, what is it? He's talking about the Trojans coming here, basically, found in London.
Right, right. The Trojans over Greece.
And then Romans coming
the
later on. You put me on the spot there. I always wonder where Troy was, don't I?
I'm bad, you don't know why.
I think they were, yeah. But,
yeah, I'm not too sure. But,
and then the Romans came and tried to attack him, and then he said, no, we're the same, we're all ruled in the same kind of area.
So his people said that it was the Romans that planned to help him.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, a friend of mine, Richard Darlow, knows about this stuff. It's London's before Trini Benton. There's a special London Wall, and that was a wall of Trini Benton. It's near Cannon Street Station, and that stone is there, yeah. Juicy stuff coming up now. I took a photo of that statue.
Sorry?
I took a photo of one of those statues. Yeah.
Oh, that's
quite near St Paul's, yeah.
Wow, where is it?
It's quite near St Paul's. It's a little bit further along, yeah.
Oh, lovely.
It's quite something there. Yeah, right. For academics in charge of technical equipment, it always goes wrong.
Right.
So that's still rolling on here.
Right, to be continued now. Thank you very much. Right, the exclusive City of London legal district, known as Temple Bar, has its entrance guarded by dragons, just like this one, and several of which form a permanent preserve in the anatomy of the square mile, and like the figures of Aeneas and Brutus, they too boast a heritage as symbols of the same branch of bloodline carried by the dragon queens of ancient Egypt. But this story begins, as does much esoteric history in Babylon, with the inception of the earliest dragon queens, one of the main figurines of which was Lilith, the dark goddess Caradine. Now, from the ancient figure of Lilith, the dragon line descends to the more notorious character of Nimrod before being transported into the second Egyptian pharaoh dynasty by its founder, Nimrod's offspring, Botes, and I won't pronounce his Egyptian name, who in turn had the dragon queen's spout. Now, thus the royal dragon line was cemented both in marriage and in magic. And from this union, a new pharaoh was born, Ranet, circa 2800 BC, who instigated the occulture of Chem of Capricorn and Mendes, which became the Baphomet or Goat of Mendes, as infamously adopted by the influential French occultist Alephus Levi over 4,500 years later. And that's his illustration. That's the illustration that depicts him. Mm-hmm.
Dragon Line then became Dragon Court under the patronage of the priest prince Akhundkhunsa circa 2170 BC before officially being constituted into the Egyptian Pharaohic line by Queen Sobek Nefu nearly 1,000 years later. But this is when it starts to get interesting, because according to several leading researchers into this field of ancient Middle Eastern monarchical dynasty, if I can say that, the dragon line then became embedded into the Hyksos Pharaoh kings, who were expelled out of Egypt owing to their worship of the ram. And the priesthood of the Heliopolis mystery school had decreed the aeon commencement of the astrological age of Aries at the expense of Taurus the bull, and he became the astrological ages rotate slowly backwards with the passing of time. The Hyksos became known as the Shepherd Kings, and their departure from Egypt coincided with that of the biblical Israelites, the 12 tribes of Israel. But this was no coincidence, because according to the researchers of Ralph Ellis and David Roll, the Shepherd Kings and the 12 tribes of Israel were one and the same body of people. And if this notion is correct, and it's gaining more support amongst academics and alternative historians alike, it would explain why the ancient Hebrew chroniclers had to hide the fact that the Exodus people were seriously well-connected Egyptians and present them as poor Israelites instead. And they also hid the strong likelihood that the secret knowledge embodying the dragon bloodline came out of Egypt too, with the Israelites or rather the renegade Hyksos. Royal romancers and similar believers alike have dubbed this the Jesus bloodline, but they could well be a nasty shopping store. Leading occult researcher and journalist Tracy R. Twyman has contended that this is really the bloodline of Cain. And the so-called secret knowledge is that this is also the bloodline of the Watchers, or fallen angels, which the secret society networks are protecting. Notwithstanding that this bloodline also includes those descendants from the royal house of Judah, one of which was Dara, whom the British Israelite contingent say is really Dardanus, the Trojan founder, and an ancestor of the iconic figures of Aenys and Brutus, which, of course, John has just mentioned. But there is another Trojan connection with the elements of the Watcher's bloodline, which moved out of the Middle East into Scythia before looping back into Troy. Either way, the ancient city of Troy, rather, was a connection point, a vortex of energy and bloodline linkage, a key factor in the story of Aeneas and Brutus and the latter's inception of London. But did the secret knowledge also come to ancient London, and is this in part symbolised by the dragons as today's keepers of the city? Probably won't be able to see that. One answer to this tantalising question could lie in a set of series of mysterious documents belonging to the fabled Priory of Sarum, entitled The Serpent Rouge or the Red Serpent, which first came to light in somewhat bizarre circumstances in 1967. But some suggested that these documents were part of an elaborate hoax perpetrated by an elderly Frenchman named Pierre Plantard, who is pictured here. Whilst others are convinced that they are genuine, particularly as they reveal knowledge of genuine esoteric enigmas known to few people outside the secret societies, such as the Fire of Sion, which is an important point because it's the contents that matter. And in this respect, the most significant disclosure in the Serpent Rouge is a 13-page document comprised of poetical pieces related to each of the signs of the zodiac, but with one difference: an additional sign was added, Ophiuchus or Serpentarius, sandwiched between Scorpio and Sagittarius, known as the 13th sign, Hidden House of the Dragon. And what this refers to is a completely alternative system of astrology, one which relates more to the lunar rather than solar symbolism, as it uses the moon's phases instead of the sun's positions. And this carefully guarded secret astrology preserved in secret societies is based on the female menstrual cycle of the goddess, which of course is pivotal to the lunar worship and witchcraft in general. The text of the dragon or serpent section of the text in the primary document begins as follows: cursing the profaners in their ashes and those who live in their tracks, leaving the abyss where I was plunged and finishing the gesture of horror. Here is the proof that I knew the secret of the seal of Solomon, that of his queen I have visited the hidden residences. Now, there are some quite profound symbolical connotations here. Firstly, the angel of the abyss is a baton, and the sacred word for the High Masonic Knights of the East and West, the same body of people who created the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. And the ritual that reveals the name of a baton originated in Palestine and was brought to the West by the knights, 11 of whom were bound by oaths of secrecy undertaken by a special council. The queen referred to in the text is Isis, pictured here, and the multifaceted Egyptian goddess to which she is. But the most significant reveal in the prose is Isis' claim to know the secret of the seal of Solomon, the six-pointed star of David formed by two interlocking triangles which appears on the current Israeli flag, but has nothing to do with Judaism, everything to do with Zionism, which is an extreme political and religious movement. However, its origins, along with its real meaning, can be traced right back to Babylonian times. In Phoenician pagan aspect, it represents Saturn, pictured here, who has many guises, and these include Cronus, Baal, and Molech, but the most significant is undoubtedly as El, the old Lord God of the world, supreme father of the gods, and it is from the El prefix that we get words such as elite, elevated, elected, and elemental, to name but four. Saturn's colour is black, along with the square and other of its representations, which features strongly in Masonic symbolism. The graduating university student wears a black square multiple and gown, signifying that they have now joined the elite scholars. Saturn also has legal aspects, as the court system elites also wear black robes. The judge sits at the bench, which is Latin for bank. The prisoner or defendant appears in the dock, whilst the public view the proceedings from the gallery. These terms are all remnants of ancient admiralty law, the law of the sea, a higher law, which has also occult and esoteric implications, and it is the higher law that is administered from the Temple Bar and the Chancery areas in the City of London. The word Bar means legal elites. Saturn is the god of banking, and in the City of London there is of course a large banking and financial sector, and these corporations even have their own Masonic lodges, one of which they are more concentrated within the City of London than anywhere else on earth, apparently. The name Saturn is associated with Satyr, a type of goat-headed man who in Greek mythology inhabited Arcadia. Cain was said to have similar attributes, largely as a product of an experiment between Enki Samael and his daughter Eve. In the ancient Sumerian culture, Enki was one of Saturn's many guises. Samael merely refers to his role in serpent dragon mode. When his offspring Cain reached adulthood, he was then mated with Lilith, Lilith Arlula, the pure bloodline daughter of Lilith, the original Anunnaki dragon queen, and that's pictured there. Thus the bloodline of Cain was forged, but it was derived from that of the fallen angels or watchers. Now the writer Ignatius Donnelly said the Bible does not tell us that the race of Cain perished in the deluge. The people that were destroyed were the sons of Jehovah who died in the flood, not the race of Cain, which has been stipulated by the Hebrew chronicle. So where did the race of Cain end up? Well, in Jewish legends, Cain and his descendants lived in a place called Arca, a subterranean environment from which the Greek Arcadia is derived. Now, Tracy R. Twyman maintains that this was the cave of treasures, or holy mountain, that the six-pointed star, the seal of Solomon, which symbolises the mountain where Cain and his father Saturn were both buried. Now, this is quite an obscure theory on the place of it. Nonetheless, it is based on many years of research. The son of King David, Solomon, used this symbol, of course, in his star altar dedicated to Ashtaroth, its crown of the Magi, star of David. It's dedicated to Ashtaroth and Saturn, and the latter, which became widely known as the symbol of the Star of David, which is the Rothschild family crest. And it is more than likely that they know its real meaning as an occult symbol for Saturn, linked to the bloodline of the fallen angels shown here as the crown of Magi. But did this secret knowledge find its way into the archives of the Priory of Sion, and were the Templars originally privy to it? When the French king, Philip the Fair, issued the secret instructions for all Templars to be imprisoned on Friday the 13th, 1307, there were some that were excluded from this purge, notably those in residence at Bayeux and Rennes-le-Château, the closest to the author of Sion, which of course gave its name to the latter more questionable Priory of Sion. Here, were this group of Templars rather in possession of the secret knowledge, and in some way rendered them beyond the hand of this Inquisition? Now, the mysterious number 13 has been associated with the Templars, largely due to the exact date of their seizure. But could there actually be another, more deeper, much deeper level of mystery involved here? The discovery of a silver-gilded female head idol, unearthed during a parish raid in the Temple Preceptory, contained two skull bones inside bearing the curious inscription, Caput, Head, 58 or 58 M. Now, when the latter's two numerical digits are added, we get the number 13, which is also the alphabetically sequenced number of the letter M, which, when written in this form, also corresponds to the astrological sign of Virgo. And this is linked to Isis and further back to Queen Semiramis and Lilith. In other words, this is the goddess, and when the word Baphomet, which the Templars were accused of worshipping, is translated into Hebrew, and the Akbash cycle is applied, it immediately converts into Sophia, one of the two deities that the Templars were accredited or venerating as Baphomet. And this is Sophia, and of Sophia, the author Caitlin Matthews says, this school of dark night spirituality is found in most traditions that venerate the black goddess, not because she is sinister or evil, but because she is the powerhouse from whence our spirituality is fueled. Now, to this important point, I would just add that the precise nature of this or any ritual is fully dependent on the will of the participants, so it really amounts to anything that they want it to be. And in this case, the dragon of the black comb goddess is transformed into the maiden of Sophia. Now, dragons, Templars, number 13, Freemasons, bankers, all come together in the city of London, which is an entirely independent sovereign state with its own infrastructure, which is administered and controlled by the City Corporation, a committee of 12 to 14 men who preside over the wealth of the Crown lands and the companies that are linked to them. Perhaps unsurprisingly, this group of male controllers is known inside the city as the Crown or Crown Temple, as the latter controls the global legal system, including Admiralty Law, which I mentioned earlier. This is overseen from inside Temple Bar, and I've already looked at the word bar and some of its meaning, so now let's just consider to finish the word temple. Most people would say that in this instance it refers to an arch-temple church, which is situated at the heart of Temple Bar, but the word temple means a pre-Christian place of ritual and worship where the priesthood or elite held sway over the initiates. So the name Temple Bar has one common denominator in the guise of El, as in elite, the legalese of the bar, and in the religion of the temple as El or Saturn, the elite of which carry the bloodline of Cain and the fallen angels. But the big question still remains. Was this knowledge brought to London? If so, by whom? How much did the Templars really know? The answers to these tantalising questions in part two. So we'll now take a short 15-minute break, and if anybody wants to, is interested in any copies of my previous books, The Demonic Connection is for sale with Wayne over there. Thank you very much, and we'll see you in 15 short minutes. Don't go too far.
Ladies and gentlemen, through the fog of those two or three bottles of red wine I was having with John Redley, he was testing me out. I do remember Brutus and something about the Monmation Road, and it was safe on it. So
He's been doing this a long, long time. I mean, John and Toy are so passionate about the knowledge they want to bring to you. And I didn't get a chance to introduce Toy the first time around, but you probably all know him because he wrote a book about the Clapham Woods Mysteries, which is up near Chantonbury Ring. And he wrote a book, The Demonic Connections, 25 years ago. First time flight. So we're going to start the second half, and John is going to do a presentation, and then Toyn as well. So it's going to be great fun, I'm sure. Hopefully, they tell me that the book's coming out on August the 31st. I don't know why I'm laughing, it's not fair. But, you know, let's hope it does. And I'm sure you'll be able to order your books and get a signed copy from Toyn and John before then. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce John again. Thank you.
Doing this talk, we talked a little bit before about the established history, the canon, which is London being a Roman city, and I talked a little bit of the anti side, the secret side, the forbidden history about Brutus. I'm just going to show you some photographs. I think the words are done for me. I'm just going to go through some photographs and talk about those things and perhaps suggest some alternative meanings to them. Right, this is an established sort of view. It's taken in the 60s. A guy up in Primrose Hill doing his Druid bit. And he's Druid. It's a modern thing. We've all got this in our mind. When we think of Druid, a guy dressed in white. Okay? But I would like to suggest to you, have a look at this other photograph. Quite modern. Come out here. This is taken quite recently. Now these two guys are the keepers of the sanctuary and they work in Westminster Cathedral. Now I would suggest to you this is a closer approximation and survival of your Druid, because these people are still enacting the laws and behaving in the same way as if the Narmutius Code was still alive today. They're searching the sanctuary to see if the right people are there. You've got sanctuary, she hasn't. You've got sanctuary, she hasn't, or whatever. And that's their role. But in actual fact, in the modern world, they've probably got more of a clerical role. It's still sort of ceremonial. But if you think of Druid in the future, just remember these two guys. You're probably closer to the truth than the other image. Let's go up here. Now, this is very interesting, I think, because this ceremony happens every year. And you think, oh, it's a lovely quaint ceremony. He's got in his hand a billhook, which is a bit like a druid's scythe. And Toyn was talking about Saturn. This man is a legal man. He has to do this every year on behalf of the Lord Mayor. It's called the quitting the rent ceremony. And he has to cut a piece of wood with his billhook. In his other hand, which you can't see from this photograph, he holds a hazel wand. Now, I would like to suggest to you that that is very druidic. And the livery companies say that although, and historians, if you're in the audience, will tell you that this is only a role dating from medieval times, the livery companies themselves say this role dates from great antiquity. And I think those words sum up something. This is a druidic role. And you might think, well, it's a lovely quaint ceremony, so what? This man has a permanent seat in the House of Lords. A very, very high member of the judiciary who answers only to the Queen and the Lord Mayor. Right now. Right. Now, talking of Druids, who do we see here? In the middle of the Druids. And that's his initiation ceremony, Burnhurst. That's Winston Churchill becoming a Druid. A lot of people say, well, you know, other people get involved in societies, etc. Remember, he stopped the ravens during the war. He knew a lot about the myths. And there's a lot of things. There's Mr. Churchill again. And the stamp. So they put out a stamp with Mr. Churchill and his Masonic affiliations. So it's put on letters. It's around. Here, opposite St Paul's, you can see a church. You come out opposite St Paul's, turn left adjacent to the road, and you'll come across this strange clock which has the black sun in the middle and these wonderful astrological symbols, and that's Churchill there, and that's to thank Churchill for defending the city and winning the war. So he's a roundabout, I like that. Here, Guildhall, everybody knows about Guildhall, the main place for the sort of livery companies and the Lord Mayor. But what people don't realise is the significance of Guildhall. Guildhall was where the palace, where the exact spot, according to folklore, where Bruce of Troy had his palace. And this is your history. They still meet there, and within there, there are two statues, which are mentioned in our book, which are called Gog and Magog, which are very... how shall we say, entwined with the city of Regalia. They're mentioned in the Quran and they're mentioned in the Bible. But they're in there. And interestingly, this place was bombed during the war. Churchill was the one who had it restored. And he said, whatever you do, you must get Gog and Magog, those statues, made ASAP and put in there before anything else. And he was very, how shall we say, anxious to see them back with him. I wonder why. Now, I talked earlier about underneath St Paul's Cathedral, St Faith's, this church which was sort of encompassed by the new St Paul's, where all the great and the good are sort of laid to rest. This is one old photograph of it. You probably, I don't know if you can go in there, we're so busy with the book, I've never actually tried to get in there. It'd be interesting to see what's in there and go around. Everybody that's anybody is in there, and this is probably the original, I would suppose, the original spot where the Temple of Diana founded by Brutus was, I would say. I don't know that, so I'm just saying it off the top of my head. But interestingly, just a street away recently, within the last 2 or 3 years, they've unearthed some bones. Archaeologists have been spat on tonight a little bit. Archaeologists have unearthed some bones, and those bones were bones of stags and bones of cows. And immediately, in a knee-jerk reaction, they said, this is a sacrificial site for the Romans. Well, we know, to my own know, that the Romans actually sacrificed to a different god, an Iranian god called Mithras, which they sacrificed their stuff to over in Bucklesbury. They may have come here to sacrifice this. We know that the bones of cows and stags are sacrificial offerings to which god? Anybody? Gold star for anyone? Diana. So this is definitely very close to the Temple of Diana. Now wandering around the city, you might see some of these guys. Toy and I were actually on a little meal. We quite innocently bumped into all this crowd. This is an old photograph from the 60s, but we bumped into, what was it? Princess Anne. We bumped into Princess Wellington then. We were a bit nicer. Princess Anne, Princess Royal.
All good crowds. Yeah,
we bumped into them at St Paul's. We were just hanging around and said hello or something. These guys, it's the aldermen, they have a right to vote on the new Lord Mayor. And if you don't know about the Lord Mayor, the City of London, forget about London as a capital. The Roman walls of the city, a small area called the Square Mile, where all the financial district is ruled by these guys, the livery companies. They have the right to say who is the Lord Mayor. You might think, well, big deal. But the Lord Mayor is the sovereign of the city. When the Queen enters the city, the old city, the Square Mile, she must get out of her carriage and she must go up to the Lord Mayor, who surrenders his sword as a sign of peace, and she must walk behind the Lord Mayor. But these guys got a lot of power, as you know from the gentleman in black who was cutting the faggot with the billbook and all the rest of it. These guys elect the Lord Mayor. The Lord Mayor is the sovereign of the city. No one is higher. And in fact, Queen Elizabeth I decided to take issue with the Lord Mayor, and she was told, the Lord Mayor is the Admiral of the Thames, he's the sovereign of the city, and he's in charge of the tower, along with you. You share the tower with him, and you have to give him the password every year. And all these ceremonies go on, and these guys have got a lot of power, but you don't know it.
another person.
This is the sheriff. You've heard of the sheriff from the West End. This is the genuine sheriff. This is the sheriff from the city. The original sheriff. And these guys oversee a lot of legal matters. They can hold courts. They hold a sort of voting thing where they can elect magistrates and so forth, and they have the right over all of the legal matters of the city. And you might think, well, what is the city? The City of London Corporation, it's not allowed to publish its accounts. They are so large. The Queen and the City of London have secret accounts. These guys handle a lot of money in the city. The time will cover that off later, and I'm talking vast amount. And in times past, they set up something called companies. East India Company, which founded the empire in India. The United States of America was the Virginia Bay Company, ruled by these guys, which set up the United States of America, that's from the country you might have heard of, and the Hudson Bay Company, which controls to this day most of Canada. So, now this guy, I've just included this as a bit of a whimsical thing. He's the actual porter of the Vintners Livery Company. I know it's a silly thing, I've cut it off a little bit short, but he's holding a broom. And what he does, when the Lord Mayor walks around certain parts of the city, he sweeps in front of him. So there's a procession, yeah? And there's the procession. Yeah, this is the modern one, that old photograph from the 60s, different guy. He sweeps in front of him. But that's the bit, but we can do it for the Lord Mayor. Now, a lot of people think the position holds great antiquity. I don't know. Isn't in the book, just like to think about this, open-mindedness, is it not clearing the space and paganism? The birch rule? I don't know. But it seems to be half framed. Now this guy's interesting. He's got a runner from China, and they do actually wear this. This guy is the doorman, or the opener from the Bank of England. I've never seen one. I've been around the Bank of England quite a lot. Have you ever seen one? No, I don't think. Now, this photograph's not very good. It's an old photograph. But the ribbon seems to be white. It's not white, it's gold. And the reason it's gold is because the Bank of England controls the world's gold supply. Don't know if you know that. Five men meet in a room, they're not elected, unelected, five men, and they control the world's gold price. And they set the world gold price, even for America, even for the Federal Reserve. And that is part of it, is that they showed that. In recent times, they haven't been setting the price officially, but I assure you, I don't think you relinquish a business like that too easily.
Who's Belinus?
Well, he's a Celtic king, the son of Mamutis. There it is, frozen bit. It's still going on to this day. The last thing I'll end on, just a little fun. I've thrown this in, it's not in our book, but it's just a question mark you might like to answer. This is an old photograph. Only two pubs play this game. It's a game peculiar to London. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. You have come across skittles, I'm sure, nine pins that are placed on a table within holes, and you throw a ball and you knock pins down, rather like bowling. This game is different. It's called London Skittles. Skittles comes from Holland and Germany. That's where it comes from. This game is London Skittles.
And the difference is
London Skittles. Oh, that's upside down. You've had a few drinks. You can
do it. London Skittles, it revolves around the cheese.
That's the difference. It doesn't revolve around the bowl. It's like a sort of fine saucer shape. You toss it along and you hope to knock down the pins. Now this game has been researched for years. Guess where it comes from?
Very interesting.
Libya, Turkey. And if you wanted proof of our Trojan forebears, you're looking at it there. Thank you very much.
Speech, but anything else, you know, just clean it up a bit.
Does that take a while?
No, it's very easy.
Is that when you've got it on the computer?
Yeah, you know what to do, yeah. Changes the position of this now. Speakers coming down here. So.
Mobile service has now been resumed. Secret Societies and Subversive Movements, Nestor Webster's first book, published in 1924, is a particularly prescient work, especially in view of what's currently occurring behind the scenes of the global political theatre. Now, if we take a look at the front cover of this reissued copy, we can clearly see a couple of sideways-looking goddess figurines holding up the crown with one hand whilst unveiling what is underneath in the form of a skull sitting in a grail or Rosicrucian cup with the other hand. Now, this artwork imagery provides us with parallels between occult symbolism in various guises. There are also links between occult notation, dragon symbology, along with the number 13, and the founding and centuries-old continuation of the Order of the Garter, which is Britain's most premier order of knighthood. But this ostensibly Christian most noble order seemingly has much more pagan connotations within its roots, as does the venue of its ceremonial investitures, St George's Chapel, Windsor Castle. Now, this was featured in the BBC TV series Britain's Best Buildings, in an episode about Windsor Castle, which they disclosed that St George's Chapel contained an intricate arrangement of circular geometrical configurations that goes to define the Virgin Mary, or more specifically, her genitalia, and it was this particular aspect that the whole building was dedicated to. But this cult of the female sexual aspect can be traced much further back to the dark goddess of pagan times in the old religion. Writing in his book A History of White Magic, Gareth Knight says feasts, along with the physical assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary in August, go back to the mistress of Isis and coincide with major pagan festivals. The Order of the Garter is connected to the old religion in a number of ways. Firstly, in the manner of the actual founding of the order by Edward III, which was based on a garter worn by a countess which accidentally fell to the floor while she was dancing with the king at a royal ball. Now, on immediately retrieving the fallen garter, the king was heard to say, "Shame on him who thinks evil of it," that being the translation from the Latin, which I won't attempt to reproduce now, because it's a little bit too much of a mouthful. But the king used the Latin before donning the garter himself. Now, leading pagan authority and author Dorian Galienti says that this incident was a very trivial one to have generated the order of the garter's founding, and more or less. The dropped garter had some inner significance, such as a dropped witch garter, in which case, as Dr. Margaret Murray comments, the possession of the garter proved that she was not only a member of the old religion, but that she held the highest place in it. A view which is further fortified and expanded on in this book, The Dragon Legacy by Nicholas de Vere, who is a fairly controversial figure in himself. But it shouldn't be forgotten that most of the material in Lawrence Gardner's best-selling Genesis of the Grail Kings was sourced from this book, de Vere originally, or rather, de Vere's archives originally, before he published this book. This actually came out after Lawrence Gardner's best-selling work. Now, he maintains that from the age of 7 onwards, his father told him that their ancestry was steeped in royal blood, and most significantly, what is termed as royal witchcraft. Now, this diagram that he shows is known as the crest, and it displays a lineage of genealogy of the Royal House of Wales, royal family, and the royal dragon blood that De Vere claims throws through their veins. Now, the former head of the dragon court, De Vere, says that the Windsor Royal Couple, that's what he actually calls it, and many others, reputedly old hereditary family groups, were the custodians of traditions which had, by their own admission, little or nothing in common with the modern neo-pagan revivalist movement or its reconstructed rituals. What De Vere is actually saying or describing here is an elitist form of witchcraft that claims to have and be based upon a hereditary bloodline, which is very different to the modernistic reinvented witchcraft of General Gardner. In the case of the Order of the Garter, in its real guise is an Angevin Elven bloodline institution which continued in the form of the Plantagenet kings, one of which was the founder of the Order of the Garter, Edward III, who of course was descended from the Angevin dynasty. And in his occult conspiracy book, Michael Howard builds a link between the Order of the Garter and the Rosicrucians when he says that many famous men who were either Freemasons or Rosicrucians have over the centuries united as members of the Order of the Garter. And De Vere also reveals a link between the Dragon Court and the Order of the Garter in the form of his lateral ancestors, the Earls of Oxford. And five of these people were also Order of the Garter admittance. One of these, Earl Richard De Vere, also received a degree of Societas Draconis, Princess Mary Seen's Dragon Court. Now this is the European reconstituted version of the old Egyptian dragon court, which had been undertaken by Sigismund, King of Hungary, who also later became admitted into the Order of the Garter's Princess degree, along with Richard de Vere at St. George's Chapel, Windsor, in 1415. So he was linked with the old Egyptian dragon court, the reconstituted European one, and the Order of the Garter, all coming together. Sigismund, who had been crowned by the Holy Roman Emperor in 1411, decided to expand the Dragon Order in 1431 to include a plethora of influential nobles from political and military backgrounds who were subsequently initiated into the Order of the Garter. Yes, and was subsequently initiated not into the Order of the Garter, into the Dragon Order, I should say, sorry. And amongst these was this gentleman, Vlad II Dracul, whose name means devil or dragon, and his son, Vlad Tepes, signed himself as Dracula, or Dracula, with a Y, Y-A at the end, the devil's son. And he later became Dracula, which roughly translates to the son of him who had the order of dragon. However, it is his sister who is of particular interest here. Yes, we knew she was going to come up sooner or later, didn't you? Because amongst her descendants is one Mary of Teck, Queen Mary, mother of King George V and grandmother to the current monarch. There she is, Queen Elizabeth, who is also a current head of the order. And in this particular illustration, she's receiving the ceremonial sword of Leia at Temple Bar. This is the ceremony that she has to go on before when she enters the city of London. And in fact, it's the only ceremony that I can think of where she actually has to concede. She bows to them and the Lord Mayor and asks him for permission to enter the city, and he gives her his sword, which she carries around the city, but she has to return it afterwards because he can't leave the city. That's that. And of course, she is the current head of the Order of the Garter. Now, why did Prince Charles is so interested in this bloodline? And according to former MI6 agent John Corman, the Order of the Garter has a secret function in overseeing a mysterious group called the Committee of 300. And to quote here, only 300 men, each of who knows all the others, govern the fate of Europe. They select their successors from their own entourage, and these men have the means in their hands of putting an end to the form of state which they find unreasonable. Now, this quote, which appeared in the Vienna Press, was taken from one article published in 1921 by one Walter Raffineau, a financial advisor to the Rothschilds, so in effect he should know. Coleman claims that although the Committee of 300 has existed for 150 years, its agenda was always implemented through front organisations such as the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And the latter is an integral part of this, the Round Table Network, not to be confused with a charitable organisation bearing the same name. This is the handiwork of Neil Hay, who you've probably seen in some of David Icke's works. Now, the Round Table was founded by Cecil Rhodes, acting in the interests of the Welsh Lord Rothschild, with the express aim of creating a secret society that could manipulate events that would lead to the introduction of centralised global control administered from the City of London. Now, some scholars and researchers alike think that the Round Table is merely the Committee of 300 in another name. Apparently, the Committee now refers to themselves even as the World Government Founders of the New World Order. So, spot the difference there. Both groups have an inner elite. The Committee is called the Olympians, which is actually another name for the 300 as well. A prominent member of the Round Table in the elite was Lord Astor, who later owned the Times newspaper. Now, this is significant because Call Me Dave, our current Prime Minister Cameron, is closely connected to the Astor family. As one of them is his mother-in-law through the second marriage to William Astor, the fourth Viscount Astor. Thus, Samantha Cameron, Dave's missus, thus Samantha Cameron's mother is now Viscountess Astor. So it's not actually a bloodline descent, but the connection is well, but it's still close enough to be of significance. And looking at the Round Table plan here, those of you who are familiar with David Icke's research, we'll no doubt recognise the usual suspects that are displayed here. Now, I've already mentioned the Royal Institute for International Affairs, of which, of course, the Queen is patron, and you can clearly see here the Bilderberg Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Club of Rome, the Trilateral Commission, which also has 300 members, and the UN itself. And one other organisation founded by the Royal Institute for International Affairs in connection with the Committee of 300 is the Tavistock Institute, which is also important. Now, Dr. Coleman describes the Committee of 300 as the ultimate secret society made up of an untouchable ruling class, which includes all the European royal families. On the death of Queen Victoria, these aristocrats apparently decided that in order to gain worldwide control, it would be necessary for them to go into business with powerful corporate business leaders on a global scale. And I think we can see some of that, or one, if not all of it, being currently played out right now. However, more than a century ago, Joseph Stalin, of all people, referred to this secret global elite as dark forces, a phrase recently used by the Queen herself before she added the caveat, which we know nothing about. That's if we accept the role of Paul Butler, the role of Princess Diana. Whereas other world leaders really describe them as the magicians. Was there an occult connection here? According to Coleman, the Order of the Garter is the overriding determinant here. So if you look at this data used in the secret zone, you can see that it is a small buckle belt that was worn around by women around the top of the knee at the left of the left thigh, just below the left knee on the neck. And this gentleman here is a Gartenite whose left knee is suitably covered by this guard. De Beer tells us that the garter was the witch's belt, the devil's badge, the dynastic emblem of a race that had descended from Lilith and Cain. And apart from being a mentioned badge and a semantic symbol, the wound on the rail was a representation of a serpent eating its own tail. Thus, the garter, in its true guise, is an alchemical ouroboros serpent, which by devouring its own tail itself becomes a dragon, and that symbolism is to the power of the imperial and royal dragon court of today.
I'm going to put your hands on next time.
That's on the side, which should be the other way up forever. This illustration is the handiwork of Pierre Sabbat from his book The Murder of Reality, and this is the Ouroboros serpent clearly seen biting its own tail, and the author describes this as the red serpent emblem of the city of London, which is also a symbol of the money power of a London banking cartel, according to American preacher Baptist L.B. Walker. Now, this gentleman made several visits to Victorian London after the American Civil War, seeking out banksters and interviewing them if he could in his never-ending search for the strands of the leading banking cartel in the city. And what he found was that the cartel owned almost all the world's debts, nation-states, corporations, as well as individuals, and they regulate money matters using their own methods. Now all this, remember, was 150 years ago, so no change there then, and no pun intended either. Central to the city banking cartel is, of course, the Bank of England, which is only momentarily, was nationalised shortly after the end of World War II, and is currently under public ownership, but is it? In 1977, the parliamentary question established that the Bank of England has a special nominee company called the Bank of England Nominees Limited. Now the last three letters are of course the most important here because that establishes that it is a private company. The names of its shareholders are protected by a parliamentary act and no accounts are available for public scrutiny. Writing in his book Empire of the City, author Ian Nuth says the international oligarchy uses the allegoric crown as its symbol of power and has its headquarters in the ancient city of London. The giant Bank of England is a privately owned institution and is not subject to regulation by the British Parliament and is in fact a sovereign world state. And this is the 1780 version of it, which is probably one of the earliest incantations. And certainly one extraordinary story involving the Bank of England occurred in November 2010 when Lord James of Blackheath got up in the second chamber of the House of Lords and disclosed that he had been appointed by the Bank of England to deal with problems created by the laundering of IRA funds. And his job was apparently to run down the companies containing the IRA money and liquidise whatever assets were left. And he said that he had one of the biggest experiences in the laundering of terrorist and funny money that anyone has had in the city, and winning billions of pounds in the process, and writing off £1 billion from the IRA alone, his biggest client, amidst gasps from the assembled lords in the chamber. Then the next day, he declared that he was a money washer, not a money launderer, but the most intriguing part of all this story was that he claimed to have been contacted by a mysterious, shadowy organisation simply called Foundation X. Foundation X, rather. One didn't contact them, they contacted you, Lord James added to his further shell-shocked lords. He continued with X's proclamation to pledge $22 billion into the UK economy. He also claimed that they had more gold on hand than all the world's reserves combined. He had been tracking this strange covert organisation for the previous 6 months and concluded that they were genuine and sincere. But Her Majesty's Treasury were not impressed and declined Foundation X's offer. And since then, little or nothing has been heard from Lord James, Foundation X, or the $22 billion supposedly to come into the economy. But the last time that an apparently benevolent secret society have access to such wealth of this equivalent magnitude was for Knights Templar prior to their purge, but there was more to them than their true occult role. Now, I've previously spoken about the Templars and the secret knowledge the bloodline of Cain and Saturn, the fallen angels, as protected by such as the Dragon Court and the Order of the Garter. But Brutus was an early bringer of this knowledge, along with the Druids, to ancient London, but it is also the case that the Baptist preacher Wolfert found a link with the 19th century banksters and the Cain bloodline through the red dragon serpent symbolism that forms a core part of the Priory of Signs of the Serpent Moon, containing the 13th astrological sign of the dragon. Secret of Seal of Solomon, the Rothschild Star of David, is really the star of Saturn, remember, who is the father of Cain in the guise of Enki Samael, not Seth or Adam. So what we seemingly have here is the elite, including the bankers, who believe that they are the inheritors of London's mystical legacy and that of the world too, by being in possession of certain secret knowledge. They currently know more about us than we do about them, but this is being reserved by exposing them. And I'll just end on this last note. They are a dark cabal who don't like the light being shot upon them. By availing ourselves of knowledge, which is power, remember, you can take the power back into the hands of the people, which is what the elite fear the most. You making it your legacy, not theirs, so your full spiritual potential can be completely fulfilled. Thank you very much.
I've been wrong-footed every moment this evening, ladies and gentlemen, by Sloan and John. I don't know quite what to say about all these things. It's just kind of tons and tons of information. This book must be about this big, I guess, but it gets published, I don't know. So have another drink, enjoy yourself. Tomorrow evening we are at the Friends Place. Everybody know where the Friends Place is in Brighton?
Chip Street.
If you don't know, ask me, and I'll probably misdirect you. And it's, what's his name? I've forgotten.
John Bronson.
Toying around on the stage so fast, I have no idea what's happening. So have a see you tomorrow evening. We can't have a drink in the Friends Centre, of course, but I bet we'll have a drink afterwards in the pub over the road. So thanks very much. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you.
I'm not going tomorrow.
No, are you going to go to the pub now?
I think we will. Let me just try and get this to go off.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.